Sheffield Live, made in Sheffield, made by you.
Every Sunday morning at 9, join me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. Each week we'll be exploring the wonderful world of modern jazz. From hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz, Sunday mornings at 9 on Sheffield Live.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
This is Sheffield Live.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome morning. To the Lifestyles Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms, and we do get to play some rather cool music as well. You've got Julian Pauly live in the studio as usual. Later in this hour, we'll be talking to our PG. Our guest speaker normally for the second Saturday of the month is Dr. Ogo Osamo, but he can't be with us this week. But all being well, next week, and indeed every third Saturday of the month, Gareth Morgan is our guest speaker. He's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. So lots to talk about in the news this week, an interesting range of stuff. Interestingly, before we start, we saw Chris Packham last night in the Crucible in Sheffield. Apparently, he was recording a podcast, yes. But what for, we're not
in
sure.
The Music in the Realm Room, I do believe.
Yeah,
it was.
Interesting. Eh? But in the news this week, science news this week...
You might have already seen this headline. Meteorologists say the coming El Nino, currently brewing in the Pacific, is likely to be one of the strongest on record. The Pacific may seem very distant, but analysis by the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit, ECIU, suggests 13% of UK food imports worth $8.9 billion could be at risk. An El Nino occurs when waters in the eastern Pacific surge in temperature. No two El Nino events are exactly the same, but it usually leads to heavy rain and flooding in South America and dry conditions, drought and wildfires in the West Pacific, such as Australia, Indonesia and the Philippines. It can also have further reaching impacts, including a weaker monsoon in India, Winter flooding in the southwest US and a colder winter in northern Europe, including the UK. The ECIU report said, if, as expected, we see an El Nino later in 2026 and into 2027, it will turbocharge climate change impacts and likely make 2027 the hottest new year.
Interesting. Elsewhere in the news this week, and this was been brewing for a while, the UK government is expected to announce a social media ban for children next week that would be partly based on the experience of Australia. They are expecting some backlash there. The children, by children, it means under 16s, but quite a lot of the country, I think, believes that adults are just as guilty of being obsessed with mobile phones.
We saw that on the train, didn't we?
We did indeed. And that's probably a chance to remind you of, you can go online and look at www.smartphonefreechildhood.org. You can sign the Parent Pact online, join parents in your area or delaying smartphones and social media.
Right, a vaccine that could protect against future mutations of viruses has been designed using artificial intelligence and trialled in humans for the first time. University of Cambridge researchers have announced it paves the way for the development of universal vaccines that could protect against a wide range of variants of a particular family of viruses such as Ebola or coronaviruses, including those that have not yet evolved and emerged.
Interesting, and this is the next story is sent in by our Chris, who's normally our guest speaker for the fourth Saturday of the month. It's about cosmetics, and this is a very interesting one, particularly bearing in mind about the social media ban for children looming for the UK. A new term has been coined by dermatologists and academics. It's called cosmeticorexia. Cosmetic orexia, which they define as having an unhealthy obsession with achieving flawless skin from a young age, leading to an obsessive use of cosmetic products. Professor Giovanni Damiani, an Italian dermatologist from the University of Milan, was so worried by the compulsion of some of his younger clients, he began to investigate what was happening. He interviewed 55 of his patients aged between 8 and 14 years old. Those who displayed signs of cosmetic orexia were mobile phone obsessed and would spend hours watching skincare videos on social media. They would also use up to 10 different skincare products daily, and they would not socialise, even with family members, without wearing makeup. The Italian Competition Authority, or the AGCM for short, has just launched two investigations into the beauty company LVMH, which owns Sephora and Benefit cosmetic brands. The Italian Competition Authority, which is AGCM, is examining whether the brands failed to make it clear that their products are not intended for children and adolescents, and whether they are encouraging purchase through covert marketing strategies involving young micro-influencers. The Advertising Standards Authority, or ASA, in the UK says it is monitoring developments in Italy very closely, and it's confirmed that it is looking at whether there is evidence of similar issues occurring here. Well, I would say definitely. Cleanse, tone, prime, moisturise, serum, eye cream, face mist and repeat. As children, some of them primary school age, seek the Korean glass skin look. Interesting thing as well, these children are spending a lot of money on these products. Products actually, because they are young, they don't actually need. So the irony of it, says dermatologist Dr. Jean Ayer, who is an NHS consultant and private dermatologist based in Stockport. She said the irony of young children using such cosmetics, they've already got the perfect skin. They're young, your skin's in great condition. And she says your skin barrier, which keeps toxins out and keeps moisture in, is beautifully preserved when you are younger. And that's the beauty of young skin. So that's another issue. And this is all to do as well with TikTok, social media, body image, what people look like. And probably as worrying as well is young children not wanting to be seen without makeup. So what one to watch for the future as that progresses, I guess.
Mm. Elsewhere in the news, officials have admitted that Britain's data centre boom, which could draw 40% more electricity than previously thought, a surge could push up energy bills. The government's AI revolution has prompted scores of data centres to seek grid connections, requires as much as 70 gigawatts of electricity capacity in total.
Another interesting story I've noticed the last few weeks, actually, with advertisement on magazines, Sunday magazines and things. It does make you stop in your tracks when you just see a sort of blank background with a little puppy looking quite sad at you. And that's all about the testing of human medicines and surgical procedures on animals may be phased out by the UK government, as technological changes means that AI-driven data crunching may finally replace animal experimentation. Mm. So, yeah, that's another one to watch as well. And finally, and on a bit of a lighter note, well, it depends if you're a gardener or not, think twice before planting your beans out this summer. The soggy weather means slugs are on manoeuvres. Lettuce, beans and low-growing strawberries are all at risk, high risk, because generally, if we like to eat it, then slugs like to eat it as well. There's plenty of advice for dealing with slugs, though, and slug pellets are definitely not necessary. They're all part of the food chain, slugs. We just don't want them necessarily eating what we're growing. From dry mulch to beer traps and nocturnal slug hunts, there are plenty of ways to keep your fruit and vegetables protected. Fantastic track there from the ever wonderful Mr. Bill Nelson. That was The Garden from his 1982 album La Belle and the Bête, which means Beauty and the Beast, actually. And we played that because we were talking about think twice before planting out some of your little crops you're growing this year because of the slugs making up for a dry season earlier on in the year, and they're out in force now. But please don't use slug pellets. Of course, listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 until 12. Next up will be a story also probably very close to our Chris's heart. Sick of processed ham in your sandwich? Nitrate-free version may cure it. Clever, eh? So the EU has cut the maximum level of nitrates permitted in processed meat. Campaigners want the UK to follow suit. So this big article, it's written by Hugo Daniel, starts out talking about a nutritionist called Hannah Norris, who has been telling her family and clients to avoid nitrates in processed meat since she finished her degree. A decade later, the message seems to have spread. Demand for bacon and ham made without the chemical preservatives is rising. Last month, Waitrose launched two new ham ranges after searches for nitrate-free quadrupled on its website over the course of a year. It now sells six slice packs of roast and honey roast ham without nitrates. Not the only one as a supermarket, I don't think, either now. They cost the same as regular packs, and sales beat forecast by a fifth, Waitrose said. So that's 20% more sales of that than expected up to now. Nitrate-free bacon sales in Britain rose 22% last year, while traditional bacon fell by 7%, according to Consumer Analysis World Panel by Numerator. I would say we've tried nitrate-free bacon. I personally would just not eat the bacon. It's not quite the same. It's like eating pork. So, but then we've got used to that taste, haven't we? So, the industrial use of sodium nitrate, which is a form of salt, began in the 1920s, taking off on a large scale after the Second World War. Nitrates, a related preservative, are added to make pork pinker, increase its shelf life, and prevent botulism. They are used in most commercially produced hams. Concern about nitrates went mainstream in 2015, so that's quite, well, 11 years ago, actually, when the World Health Organization, or WHO, or WHO for short, classified processed meats, including ham, bacon, sausages, salami, and hot dogs, as Group 1 carcinogens. Processed meat is known to be a risk factor in bowel cancer, and rates of bowel cancer have doubled in young people since the early 1990s. So nutritionist Hannah Norris said, ham is a lunch meat people can have daily. It's that incremental, consistent eating of it, I think, is more of the problem. TV chef Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall has been making his own charcuterie for 27 years. He stopped using nitrates a decade ago. He said, if we've got the technology to avoid nitrates in cured meats, then yes, let's start the switch. I wonder how long it will become before it becomes more or less universal. France has been the leader in nitrate reduction in recent years and has a much wider selection of nitrate-free products in supermarkets. Spain and Italy use nitrates in cheaper commercially produced hams and prosciutto, although more expensive pork products tend to contain no chemicals at all. Last October, the European Union reduced the maximum permitted level of nitrates. In Britain, the Coalition Against Nitrates wants the UK to follow when the government's Brexit reset changes become legally binding. However, last year, the Food Standards Agency put out a report saying there was no evidence to suggest that processed meat made without the use of nitrates is a safer alternative, adding that the link to serious health problems like cancer remains inconclusive. So that's an interesting one. John Powell, chief executive of the British Meat Processors Association, calls nitrates a perfectly safe ingredient used for food safety, but said producers have been using new methods to reduce the levels of nitrates. Johnny Stevens, the meat, fish and poultry buyer at Waitrose, said, we know our customers are looking for a return to basics, simpler ingredients and cleaner labels. With the nitrate-free hams, we use natural flavourings to replace the role the nitrates play, maintaining the food, maintaining food safety, flavour and, most importantly, taste. Ooh. So Morrison is understood to have reduced nitrates in all its hams to match the new European standard. Tesco's own brand products are understood to fall below the legal limits in the UK and EU. The Co-op has reduced nitrate levels by 60% on its own brand bacon. Professor Ian Young, Chief Scientific Advisor at the Food Standards Agency, said it's important to understand that choosing nitrate-free processed meat does not remove all of the health risks associated with the high consumption of processed meat. Very interesting story, I thought. Track there, Chemical by Pretty Girls Make Graves. Very interesting. And we played that because we were talking about processed meats and nitrates and the shift towards nitrate-free versions. All very interesting. Of course, you're listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. Next up, Weather Eye Story by Paul Simons. He writes in The Times, and this article is a very interesting one again. It's about urban areas and flooding, and we're talking at the beginning of the show about El Nino, the El Nino weather effect and climate change, and how they're expecting El Nino to be one of the strongest on record, and therefore making 2027 likely to be the hottest on record. This article about urban areas and flooding is interesting from another angle as well. So the race to build more tall buildings in cities could be changing the climate in these urban areas, creating more rain. NASA satellite images of 44 cities across the United States showed that all the cities were cloudier than their outskirts, ranging from 1 to 15% more clouds. This made researchers wonder if the design of cities might be behind this phenomenon. So they sorted each part of the cities into high or low rise buildings and how tightly packed the buildings were arranged, as well as the width of the streets between the buildings. Some of the urban areas were dominated by high rise towers and others by shorter, more spread out buildings. The study revealed that cities with taller buildings relative to the size of their streets tended to have more clouds, although the entire size of the cities made no difference. Delving deeper into this effect revealed that taller buildings may help to lift air upwards, helping warm, moist air to rise and form shallow clouds. The effect was particularly noticeable at night when cities tended to be less windy, allowing warm air to rise more easily. This is reminiscent of the urban heat effect, when nearly 200 years ago, the pioneering meteorologist Luke Howard found that the climate of London was warmer than the surrounding countryside. We now call this effect the urban heat island, where the buildings, roads, and other man-made materials in towns and cities retain heat during the day and release it at night. With this increase in rain in cities, the talk is now of urban rain islands. So, for example, Houston in Texas was found on average to receive almost 13 centimeters. That's about 5 inches more rain each year than surrounding rural areas, and similar effects were seen elsewhere. A study in China also found that urban areas got more light rain and that this urban wet island effect has grown stronger in the past 20 years, all of which raises a question: how much of the increased rainfall may be leading to urban flooding? Very interesting.
Blue-eyed son, and where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. Stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. Been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It's a hard, and it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard. Rain's gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. Saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues are all broken. And it's a heart. It's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart. Rain gonna fall. What did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. Heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. Heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. Heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. Heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. And it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard. Rain gonna fall. Who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? Who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. I met a young woman whose body was burning. Gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. It's a heart. 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 Rain you do now, my darling young one? I'm going back out for the rain start falling. I walk to the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and their hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison. The executioner's face is always well hidden. Where hunger is ugly, where souls are forgotten, where black is the color and none is the number. And I tell it and think it and speak it and breathe it, reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I know my song well before I start singing. And it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a hard rain gonna fall. It's a hard rain gonna fall. It's a hard rain gonna fall.
Ooh, Bob Dylan live there. Hard rain's gonna fall, and that was recorded back in 71. We played that because we were talking about the article in the Times by Paul Simons. He does a weather eye column about urban areas and flooding. How much of our flooding in urban areas, or more rain in urban areas, is due to the height of the buildings relative to the width of the roads? Very interesting article.
We saw lots of them in
Liverpool
Manchester.
And Manchester, yeah. Well, all big cities, yeah, are the same, yeah. Heat Island, and now they're talking about, flood islands, water islands. And, of course, you listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Well, I thought it was keeping dry today, but then you had the rain with Bob Dylan.
I know, we did. Great track, though. I think that's to do with the George Harrison concert. It was a live version, yeah.
There's an awful lot of stuff coming out of the Beatles' cupboards in recent times, and a bit of new stuff as well with Mr. McCartney's latest release. Interesting stuff, and then did a duet with Ringo Starr.
Yeah, we were in Liverpool on Thursday, and there was a massive advertising bit on the end of a massive building. It was Paul advertising Paul McCartney's new release, I think.
Yeah, all that. But what caught my eye in Sheffield is the Sheffield Music Trail.
Oh,
and that's going to bring four free stages of Rising Star and Rising Stars to the city centre. It's University of Sheffield creating an unforgettable afternoon of free live music in venues across the city centre to showcase the mix of the finest established artists and rising stars. And it's delivered by the University of Sheffield. It's going to be on June the 20th across the centre in four stages. And it's a curtain raiser for an upcoming Sheffield City of Music report that the university's commissioned to reveal the economic and cultural impact of music on the city. So alongside the event, they're partnered with Tickets for Good and Sheffield Independent Venues Alliance to buy tickets from local grassroots spaces and distribute them to NHS staff and community members facing financial barriers. And they're bringing together this afternoon of music say, on the 20th of June. And the four stages to explore are going to be active between 12:30 and 5 p.m. at four locations. That's the Diamond Stage, which is outdoors at Levy Grieve up in the University Complex. There's going to be at Lear's Yard, and there's a stage outdoors there on Cambridge Street. It's going to be in the Winter Gardens, a stage in Surrey Street, and at Harmony Works Stage, which is in Canada House, the
commercial
property. So that's going to be a new music venue in Sheffield, which will be interesting. But Sarah Unwin, who's the head of cultural engagement at University of Sheffield, said, "The unique sound of Sheffield is a fundamental part of our city's identity, and we're thrilled to work with local music community on the music trail." And it coincides with the university's open day, so it's a great opportunity for prospective students, locals and visitors to experience their cultural vibrancy firsthand. And Neil McSweeney, who's a senior university teacher at the University of Sheffield and co-founder and director of Hudson Records, said it's the flowering of world-class musical talent that Sheffield's produced time and time again has got deep and multifarious roots, and it's important we recognise the value and distinct communities of musical practice that make up local grassroots today. Yippee!
Yeah, great. Yes. We went to see Sheffield's very own Heaven 17 last night. They were the part of the Doc Fest. New documentary being released, and it was premiered last night at the Lyceum, called The Last Temptation. Followed them on touring, and then there was a question answer with them and the guy who made it, and then they did a few tracks. It was absolutely fantastic, and it just reminds you what a musical heritage Sheffield's got.
Absolutely, and it's a great part of the things that we do around the radio station, and I think it's one of the great things of Sheffield Live, the diversity of music that passes through the station and out to local community, and we always try to support new developing musicians and local content, so it's pretty good.
I thought you might be interested as well, Paul, that they finished, they only played a few tracks, but they finished with Being Boiled.
Yeah,
which
brilliant.
Was a
I
Human League track, but Martin Ware wrote it, and it was absolutely phenomenal.
It's a cracking track, isn't it?
Isn't it? And you just think, and you think back to all that. And I thought you'd like that, Paul, because I know you turned Human League down when you were a DJ in Western Park.
Yeah.
I bet Phil's never forgiven you, has he?
No, I think, I don't know. He's probably bypassed us now. So we're not doing that sort of...
And if the University of Sheffield has got their open day on the 20th of June, they'll also be lucky enough to see the Pride of Sheffield everywhere, the Lions, as part of the Children's Hospital charity. There's some fantastic ones.
Yeah, it's a sort of busy time, isn't it? So, but it's great. I think, especially our involvement with the sort of music of Sheffield Live, that it's a great boost for local music. So good. And what you need when you're listening to some music is a fun guy, maybe
a fun girl.
Yeah. The second bit of news from the University of Sheffield is that they participated in the first global map to reveal the underground fungi networks long enough to reach the sun a billion times.
Wow.
So researchers all around the world, international team, have mapped the global distribution and mass of arbuscular mycorrhizal, and that's AM as a shortening, fungal networks.
I thought it's mycelium. Is it mycelium? Yeah. That's mushrooms, isn't it?
Mycorrhizal. It's what this one is. But the research team have done it and found this hides underneath the soils in a vast network, and it spans a distance nearly a billion times that of the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And they transport an estimated 4 billion tons of carbon dioxide equivalent into the soil each year. That's the equivalent to about 11% of all the human-related carbon dioxide emissions. So it's under our feet. It's another bit of science where we're walking all over it, but probably not realising anything about it. They're saying that grassland ecosystems are home to an estimated 40% of the Earth's AM fungal infrastructure, and flooded grasslands of South Sudan, the Everglades in Florida, and the Tibetan Plateau have exceptionally high predicted network density.
Is that because the damper?
Well, I think it's the conditions that are good, but let's say it's the first time that an international team's mapped this global distribution. And so they say that it's an interactive visualization to help reveal the scale of this thing. And I say, we're walking all over it. And we probably generally, I didn't realize it, but it was there in that form. I did realize when we've talked about the sort of rewilding and forestation that the fungal undergrowth that's there, the diversity, there's a massive interconnectivity between it, which is really strange. You know, there's an interplay between the fungus and the trees. So they can warn of drought, and they're quite resilient to changes in their sort of environment. So they form symbiotic relationships with approximately 70% of plant species on Earth. So they provide nutrients and water in exchange for carbon fixed by plants. And they say they're ecosystem engineers. So they form critical living infrastructure that draws carbon into the soil and supports much of life on Earth. So the study contributor, Katie Field, who's a professor of plant soil processes at the University of Sheffield, and the Royal Society Faraday Discovery Fellows, said, "These findings are exciting and significant because they provide the first global view of AM fungal networks, revealing an extensive but largely invisible living infrastructure that underpins plant productivity, nutrient cycling, ecosystem resilience, and the health of terrestrial ecosystems." So they say it's a major advance in identifying and quantifying the hidden fungal networks. And just a quick glance at the map sort of says to me that for the UK, they're predominantly in the north of Scotland and up into the Isles, across into Ireland and into Wales, but much less within England.
Oh, interesting. So,
yes, it's quite, and you see the banding and sort of connectivity. A lot of it's coastal, but inland. We talked about Africa last week. There's quite a substantial amount of the infrastructure in the African continent. A lot less in Australia and the islands, but through the Mediterranean, through the sort of same way through the east of the continent, there's quite a substantial bit. But researchers assembled data on the density of the AM networks from about 16,000 soil cores collected across the Earth. They developed machine learning models that could incorporate the data layers from deserts, tundra to forest, to predict the network density in areas that they couldn't sample. So using those data sets, they've estimated this total length of 110 quadrillion kilometres.
My word.
Of around the mass of around 300 megatons of carbon.
Wow.
4 to 6 times the mass of all living humans. So, incredible numbers, I think it's. I think Dr. Justin Stewart with the Society for Protection of Underground Networks says there could be up to 10 metres of the mitochondrial network in just a teaspoon of soil.
Good grief. That is mind-boggling, isn't it?
days. Absolutely. So some great news from the University of Sheffield there on a couple of disparate fronts, I guess.
Yeah, but it is interesting because, as you say, we're all walking on it, but we're not aware of it and of its importance to the ecosystem.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, so many fundamental things that are there to be discovered and are in such close proximity to us that we don't really sort of notice.
Well, interesting, like, because you've not been able to listen online. When we were waiting to see Heaven 17 last night in the Lyceum, Chris Packham happened to be in the Crucible.
All right.
And he was going into Music in the Round bit. There was nothing on at Crucible last night, I don't think. He was doing a podcast, apparently, about what we don't know. We saw him, we didn't get a chance to speak to him, but it just made me think of the Spring Watch on at the minute and the stories they're telling about, you know, seabirds, garden birds, lack of food, lack of the food chain. You know, we don't. Once you start to destroy one tiny bit of that food chain, it may be something we're not even aware of. It's under the soil, or it's some insect we don't even think about, or it's something in the sea that birds feed off. And some of the seabirds are in massive, massive decline.
Yeah. And I mean, we touched on it the other week when I was talking about the melting ice caps and the sort of massive landslides that were coming off. And that's actually starting to impact the phytoplankton, which a lot of the big whales are sort of using. So that sort of hits the complete sort of ecosystem again. And I think apart from a strange thing where they did some deep sea exploration and found what they reckon were 10 million whale remains in a sort of giant whale graveyard. This has been going on for a long time, but it's a small organism that's the linchpin beneath that for so much sort of sea
life. And this is it. So when you talk about the mushroom, well, the fungus and all that network, you just don't think about it as being important. But once you start to destroy one part of the network, everything else starts to fail.
Yes. It's really sort of, as I say, things that are not apparent all the time that are so essential. I think we need people to inform us. I think Sir David Attenborough's had a good 100-year lifespan of giving us a rude awakening to a lot of those issues. And hopefully a lot more people carry on with it just to make sure we don't let it slide, because I think that's one of the things that, what was I saying, familiarity breeds contempt. And I think a lot of people think, oh yeah, I've got a handle on that and I'll just sort of park it on the back shelf and not really sort of think about it. So anyway, talking about parking stuff on the back shelf, one of the topics that I've covered before is Alzheimer's. And researchers at ETH in Zurich have identified a new Alzheimer's target and created an experimental compound that blocks damaging processes inside brain cells. They've been working with it in mice, and the treatment slowed down nerve loss, reduced Alzheimer's-related changes, and even appears to promote a healthier ageing. And it's a promising experimental compound developed by the researchers at ETH Zurich can offer a way to slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease. In studies in mice, the treatment reduced nerve cell loss, helped the animals live longer, targeted a biological process that existing Alzheimer's drugs don't address. So the compounds known by the researchers as Compound 10 from outer space. No. it's the result of nearly 20 years of work led by Ursula Quitterer, who's Professor of Molecular Pharmacology at ETH Zurich. And the research began 20 years ago when they received brain tissue samples from a colleague at Ain Shams University Hospital in Cairo. and the samples that collected during tumour surgeries and came from both people with dementia and individuals without the condition, they helped them to work through the investigation of them to find a protein called GRK2, which has been the focus of Quittera's research for many years. And they say it plays an important role throughout the body as a regulatory protein. And we're hearing quite a lot recently in research into medical sort of areas and conditions that they're actually looking at the protein in cells. So it helps the cells respond to signals and adapt to stress. It's active in several organs, including the heart and the brain, where it functions healthy nerve cell function using both human brain tissue and mouse models. The team uncovered evidence that it may be a major contributor to dementia. And those findings were recently published in the journal Cell Reports Medicine. So it's kind of interesting work, and I think there's a lot of work with cancer cells now where they're trying to use protein as a backdoor way to enter into the cycle of cancerous cells and break the cancer link out of the cell reproduction and control the cancer. So I think Alzheimer's is a good one, and I guess I read about it more and more as I get older and older, because I start to forget things, and I think like a lot of things, I think we talked in the past about a phenomenon that seems to come about where if somebody asks you a direct question, all of a sudden your brain just empties, and until you can go off to some kind of different thing and come back to it, do you actually be able to say yes, I remember this? So it's kind of strange, and it just shows you the diversity within the human brain. So Alzheimer's, very debilitating for older people. They start to lose things like their own personality. So this GRK2 aggregates to block the pores of mitochondria, reducing the amount of energy they can supply and leading to a situation of stress inside the cells. So the team has found that that interactive GRK2 appears to increase the production of amyloid beta, a protein fragment widely associated with Alzheimer's. That creates a damaging cycle, and it places additional stress on nerve cells. So that can lead to more formation of inactive GRK2 as well. It accumulates and forms aggregates, and the disease process continues to accelerate. So compound 10 is the item that they think will break that cycle. And it says that the benefits extended beyond the brain, because the mice that they were working on appear to improve heart function, influence age-related changes, and observe that the treated animals develop fewer grey hairs as they grew older.
I think that's a minor that's a minor point, isn't it, on the scale of what they're trying to tackle?
Yeah, absolutely. But as I say, it's great to see there's so much research going on into difficult areas for human beings. And a lot of it is the development of science. As science develops, it opens different doors. So it's quite an interesting way forward, I think.
Yeah, because with dementia, there's no cure, is there?
No. That, well,
they can slow it to some degree in some instances, can't they? But there's no magic
solution. That's the thing with this. You know, you can probably delay the onset, you can probably improve the outcomes if it works in the way it is doing. And obviously, they've yet to transfer it to human beings and find out if it's consistent with their findings. But that research is going on widely into different areas related to human health.
Yeah, I did think, you know, somebody we know had an issue with a tumour near the pituitary gland. Yeah. And when you look at the pituitary gland, it's quite phenomenal. It's a tiny, I think it's the size of an almond or something, but it controls everything. And it's quite, you know, you talk about things we just take for granted or we don't really think about. But when that goes wrong, it can send all sorts of things wrong, you know. Your circadian rhythm, your body can't function properly, it's not sending the correct messages.
Yeah, well, I think in some respects, a bit like the map for the fungus, we're developing maps of a human sort of functions increasingly, and a lot of the time that's guiding research to specific areas. I think don't forget we're kind of replicating cells continually throughout our lives. Your skin surface will change, and it's developed from new cells that are grown, and various functions will go through. We can make that more difficult, reproduction, by some of the things we do, like alcohol intake, smoking intake, and make us more susceptible to problems. I think the whole thing about the brain, the problem with Alzheimer's, it just robs you of the ability to communicate eventually.
Yeah, well, lots more besides.
and takes away your recognition, and you know, it's very upsetting for relatives to see someone with Alzheimer's not able to recognise them. Say that we've covered things in past programs about things like music. You know, there are a lot of people who've tried music therapy with people in advancing stages of Alzheimer's, and it's one of those things that can trigger sort of memory from quite a while ago.
It's one of the last things to disappear, isn't it? Your memory of music.
Yeah. So, it's amazing how sort of interwoven with humanity music is.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, Paul, you've chosen a very nice piece to play you out with. Do you want to say what it is?
Well, I think it's R. Kylie, isn't it?
It is.
I Can't Get You Out of My Head.
Exactly. And on that note, brilliant stuff.
Thank you, Paul.
Sit back now and rest for the rest of the weekend, and we'll speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show 1 till 3. Okay, Paul.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.